Welcome to the Everesting Podcast, built by Quarry. In this episode, I am welcoming back Phil Rotz to the podcast. As you may remember, I had Phil on to discuss all things Everesting Rome. And Phil is a student of the Rome and actually just very recently set out to see if he could break 24 hours and complete a Rome, which is, of course, 10,000 meters of vertical gain and a minimum of 400 kilometers. He absolutely nailed it. So we talk a lot about how he had those two metrics line up and his effort, and he actually did it in under 24 hours. Unbelievable bike ride. And Phil is just a ton of fun to talk to. So I hope this episode brings on some questions. If it does, please reach out. It's podcast@everesting.com. And if you have questions for Phil, I'll make sure that they get to him and we'll have him back. He's an excellent guest and just a whole bunch of fun to talk to. So Phil, thank you so much for doing this. And this one is for all of the Rome nerds out there. Welcome back. I needed to have you back on. I knew the first time I had you on the podcast, I knew it wouldn't be the only time. I could tell. And that you were working on something. So we originally connected because I did an episode with Sir Guy Lightspeed, specifically about Everesting Rome's and that challenge. And since then, there's been a whole bunch of conversation around it. It's been really fun because people from all over the world have been reaching out and planning things, and we've gotten a whole lot of conversations started about it. And the intrigue behind it is that instead of worrying about one metric, 8,848 meters or 10,000 meters, you're now thinking about three different metrics, which completely changes the paradigm of the puzzle of the challenge, right? So now we're thinking about 10,000 meters, 400 kilometers, and a 36-hour clock. That obviously wasn't challenging enough for you, so you decided to dial that all the way back by 33% on the time and see if you could piece this puzzle together in such a way to do it in 24 hours. So why 24 hours? And then we'll break down sort of how you did it, because the sort of relief in the Rome is that sleep is allowed. I don't think you slept at all in your more recent attempt, right? So you immediately cut that out and thought, okay, here's some time saving right there. But yeah, how come a 24-hour goal? What made you think that was sort of the tip of the spear for you?
Well, the first time I tried the Rome in 2021, I didn't even make the 36-hour. So that was, over about 530 kilometers, and it took me 38 hours and 21 minutes. And so last year in 2022, I just wanted to get inside 36, and I had figured out a route, and that one was kind of semi-supported. I met a car a few times each day, and I did that one, both of those with an overnight, and that one I could finish in 34:28. And the buddy of mine who had assisted me on the first unsuccessful attempt asked me after that one, like, are you going to ever do another one? And, you know, everyone says, I'm not doing another one of these immediately afterwards. Not everyone. It seems a frequent statement.
Almost
always gets retracted to some degree. And I said to him, you know, I would love to do this with someone else as a team project. You know, how fast, how far, how could we do this, you know, trading pools and trying to get the fastest time that we could do together and have the camaraderie, because it is a lonely enterprise in large part.
It is.
And the other thing I said is, I would also be curious to see how fast I could do this now that I've gotten under 36 successfully. And I tried to hit my brother up to join me on a team attempt, or two-person attempt. He said that he had no desire to bury himself that deep. Just for his own, it didn't appeal to him, and he wasn't willing to do it for anyone else's entertainment. That's what it means.
He's like most people. That's fair.
He was quite a rational being. So this was what was left. I was trying to plan one to see if I could get it under 24 hours. In the past, when I slept, there was time off the bike that ended up being, you know, till I stopped the bike and found some food and got a shower. Like, it was about 6 hours both times, but the amount of sleep that I got in that was, you know, about 2 hours of not very good sleep. You know, in one instance, I had to change a tire, and, you know, you're fatigued and you're a tube out of a tire, and I was just fumbling around for part of that time fairly incompetently, because, you know, things that you think you can do when you're fresh just you know, they're difficult when you're a little bit cooked. And so I didn't feel like I was getting much rest by making the overnight stops. And when I looked at the one that I finished in 24 or 34 and a half, I had, my moving time was 24 hours, 12 minutes. So I thought, okay, the moving time was 24:12, and that was a 466 kilometer route. So I thought if I could stand to make the route more dense with climbing and reduce its length, I thought I at least had a chance. It wasn't a pipe dream to try to get under 24 hours.
So you thought that mathematically it was possible.
As short as possible.
Yeah. Okay. You thought if you had the fitness, you could do it. So then, and we talked about this, I've talked about this with Ronan McLaughlin as well on the podcast, who we are definitely going to give a shout out to here. The challenge has been thrown out to him and he knows it. So he's coming for a fast time. But
I'm looking forward to it whenever he gets around to it.
I know. I'm
sure he will lay down a marker that everyone can learn something from.
Yeah, I mean, he'll approach it really analytically, like you, for sure. He will. He'll look for every little angle that he can get, and then he's also obviously pretty gifted as a bike rider. So I'm excited to see what he can do. But what the most obvious thing that you could do, and if your goal was to have a fast time, is to have that 400 kilometers and the 10,000 meters meet pretty much at the same point, right? You almost exactly nailed those two things. So how much, what exactly was the total mileage and total elevation? I think you were 10,005 meters.
I turned off the unit at 10,005 and that was at 405.78 kilometers.
405.78. So that's pretty perfect. I mean, you couldn't have nailed that anymore. Did you know exactly what your route was going to be, or did you know what like 95% of it was going to be and you'd figure out the last little bit towards the end?
I knew 100% of what I rode, save for the night of the attempt. There was a road closure, a small detour that I hadn't been there during the recon. But it ended up being a very minor diversion to get back on the route. So it threw things off a little bit, but very minimally. And what I did when I planned the route, because I've had my personal experience with my own head unit, is that the count doesn't match the Strava mapping. It tracks lower. And so I made the route map to, I think, 411 kilometers. And 10,530 some vertical meters. And then I hoped it actually had me hitting 400 kilometers at 9,960 meters on the original route, but on an uphill that was, you know, would take me over 10,000 within another kilometer. My head unit ran around 400 kilometers low. But because I had mapped to 10,500, I just continued the route that I had planned. It would have hit right around 400 and 10,000 from the Strava map. But, you know, the devices don't read always to our maps. And it helped to have a plan and a really steep topography to make up the difference.
Yeah, but I mean, you were really thinking about all of the margins here, right? Right down to the end of, okay, if I, you know, how much do I need to get at the last little bit? So that's pretty clever, because it can be a really tough thing to try and figure out at that point when you're 24 hours into it. You're like, what do I do now, right? So you knew that was coming.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things I learned on my first unsuccessful attempt, was I was just riding on topography that wasn't going to deliver the density of climbing to make the time limit. So I encourage anybody who's doing it to plan the route a little bit further and maybe build in 500 extra meters, and then just be happy to turn the head unit off whenever you see the tens and the three zeros, and you know, wrap it
when
there.
It clicks over, just stop it and call for your ride.
Yeah, I wasn't paying attention to the clock so much because I had been thinking so much about 24 hours, and I hit 400 kilometers, and I was at the top of a summit, and I had 202 meters still to go. So I dropped down the other side to turn around. You know, I was watching the elevation on the head unit to be like, okay, when am I going to be at least 202 meters down from the summit? And that'll be my indicator to turn around and climb back up to finish. And it was only at that point where I was like, oh, I might be able to get this under 23 hours. And I turned around, and at that point, I didn't have the legs to do it. I wish I had noticed that earlier, because I could have probably, you know, made it under the 23, but I noticed it way too late. And that last uphill, I didn't have anything left to push it under 23, but it was.
You were on a victory lap. It's okay.
It was something that I noticed and rued a little bit on the last climb, that I hadn't been paying attention to that, because I could have chopped out some non-moving time, you know, while I was, you know, at a few stops previously just to hit that, but I wasn't paying attention.
Well, and you ended up stopping the clock at 23 hours, 6 minutes. Is that right?
23 hours, 1 minute, 40 seconds.
23:01. Oh, man. So, I mean, forget the minute that you went over the 23. That's amazing that you had this planned out that precisely, and you ended up beating it by a whole hour. Like, you probably didn't anticipate that, did you?
I wondered. One of the unknowns for me is that I can get like a metatarsalgia on my left foot, you know, like the pins and needles, hot foot kind of thing from your feet kind of swell inside the cycling shoes. And so that the unknown was like, if that flares up, I don't know how this is going to go. But it, you know, one reason that I started 3 in the afternoon and rode through the evening and rode overnight to put the deadline at 3 the next day was I thought the cooler temperatures overnight would help to eliminate some of that metatarsalgia, because it definitely correlates for me with hot weather temperatures. And we had fair weather for that. It was a little cool overnight. It got down to about 40 degrees right before dawn, but it was perfect for me and that particular issue. So that was an unknown that just happened to break in a fortuitous direction. And that was really like the thing that was gonna be the make or break issue, was whether that became a consideration that I had to factor in.
I was going to ask about start time. So I did notice your start and your finish. Was that the main motivator, was temperatures? Because you had to deal with dark at some point, right? So to me, it's like throwing a dart.
There were a few things that came together favorably to do that. One was the metatarsalgia issue, and I figured it would help with core body temperature to, you know, have, you know, I'll have the first 4 or 5 hours were pretty intense, like the climbing density the first 100 kilometers was 31 meters, vertical meters per kilometer. And so that was, for me, that was going to be a challenge. And then the two, say, bricks, 100 kilometer bricks in the middle were right. One was a little under 21 meters per kilometer for 100 kilometers, and the next one was a little over 21. And then the last one was, I don't know, 26 meters per kilometer. So I'm thinking about it as those four bricks, the intensity was at both ends. And so I thought, you know, I get that out of the way while it's daylight. It had descents that were I'd wanted to do in the daylight, as did the end of it. So that was the daylight, and the descending was the main consideration. And then the metatarsalgia, you know, issue, having the cooler overnight in the middle. And then I thought, when I did the Rome in 2022, there was one section very shaded in the middle of the afternoon where I kind of felt myself a little bit falling asleep on the bike, like 30 hours in. And so I thought, maybe as I'm fatiguing, getting in like my regular circadian rhythm of waking up in the morning, you know, hitting that in the last third or so of the effort, or the last, you know, the last portion of the effort might help me, rather than doing, you know, if you're trying to make up time and you're also into the dark at the end, that seemed unfavorable to you might be either tempted to take some risks you shouldn't, or you just might end up not being able, feeling like you couldn't do what you'd hope to do because of visibility. So I wanted to get the visibility restricted riding out of the way well before I was feeling like all the clock pressure at the end.
That's wise. Yeah, no, I'm glad that you have safety as one of your key metrics here that you're trying to put together, right? Like that's a key consideration. And the circadian rhythm is not to be taken lightly. Like that's a very real thing that happens to us. And you probably were getting a sunrise at somewhere between 5 to 5:30 a.m. at this time of year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got daylight too, right? You probably only had 5 or 6 hours of real darkness to contend with.
Yeah. Civil twilight would have ended about 9 p.m. and civil twilight kicked up about 5 a.m.
Okay. So. Okay. So how much time did you spend actually devising this route? Because it's so specific to 400K and 10,000 meters, and you absolutely nailed it again. Like that's amazing. And what combination of Strava and Google Maps did you use?
It was almost entirely Strava and Google Maps. A lot of the route I rode in a reverse order on the Rome that I did in 2022. And I just needed to find some extra places to get off the ridge and back up so that the climbing density would be greater so I could trim distance out.
Right.
And that was the main difference. So it starts behind Frederick, Maryland. There's a Catoctin Mountain Range that's there, and a lot of cyclists that live in Baltimore and DC come out there to ride hills. And so, you know, I knew that ridge was going to have a lot of potential, and it has some residential roads that no county or municipal planner should ever approve. Like they're just ridiculously steep, and you figure they were dirt tracks when people bought their plots, and then eventually they were macadamed. And, you know, I can't imagine snow removal on some of them. The pitches are just they're not rational for thinking about how vehicles move or bicycles, but you can get a lot of vertical in a short amount of time there. And so finding ways to get off that ridge and back up as I worked my way north was part of that. And then around Thurmont, Maryland, you have the Catoctin National Park where Camp David is, and there's some hills in there. And then you can get over and work your way up South Mountain. So you can work on the ridge without having to ride a lot of flats in between. You're not crossing valleys in between very much until you get, you have to cross from say South Mountain across the Cumberland Valley to the next set of mountains behind Chambersburg. So it was trying to find ways to get as much as I could out of that ridge and cross the valley at the narrowest point and then get as much as I could out of the next mountain formation to the west. That was parts of it I had ridden or mapped before. And then I did a few recon rides in April and May where I do like 100 kilometers of it and just say, well, how did that go? How am I going to feel doing that climb late in the day? Do I keep it in? Do I look for something more gentle just because that pitch is just going to, you know, be too much? And just tweaking a little bit based on a few recon rides.
Okay. Wild. So one other thing that you've, from an equipment standpoint, you've pointed out in your posts about this ride and other rides that you did this on a 2009 Specialized LA, which I love that you're pointing that out. Yes. Because it's not like that's not a humble brag. It's what I'm interpreting this as your way of saying you don't need a $12,000 bike to do something like this, right? That's the way that I'm taking that statement. I actually had a 2005 Specialized LA, which was an awesome bike. But how come you're still riding that bike? It just because it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is that it? Or are you trying to prove?
I bought that bike used in grad school, and it's still my only road bike.
Okay.
Now it has contemporary, a mix, the group set is a mix of contemporary 105 and Altegra. So the original Sora and Tiagra group set is off mechanical 105 for the shifters and then the crankset. And I guess in this case, the cassette where Altegra, everything else is 105 on it. So it has some improvements on that scale, but it's a aluminum round tube bike. It's I'm curious what I could do on something else, but that's my bike.
I love that. I love that. The only question mark to me is that you're on such steep hills on a rim brake bike. That's the only piece to me that is like, because discs, I've just recently started riding a disc brake road bike, and man, for descents, it's a different thing, especially when you're tired and stuff. You feel like you just have a little bit more leeway when you have like mountain bike style strength brakes. So if ever there's a reason for you to move over, that's it. It's not weight savings. It's just, especially when you're doing a roam, you're carrying, you probably had a battery pack for your head unit, and you probably had a bunch of consideration for equipment, right?
I did. This one, I was fortunate to have some help. So I wasn't carrying as much as I'd carried on my last one. The friend of mine from university who helped me with the first one that was unsuccessful, I was able to twist his arm to come back and help again, saying, you know, like, hopefully this one will be a successful one and not just a learning experience.
And I'm going to need you for like 12 fewer hours.
Yeah. And my brother was up from Atlanta with his family. And so they took two 12-hour shifts. And I found a hotel that was about midway on the route, that was about 10 miles from one place that the route was and 11 miles from another. And so my brother went there initially and slept the night and got up early in the morning. And then my friend Jason started with me in Frederick. And then about 3 in the morning, they handed off, and Jason, you know, took the room key and, you know, went and slept there till late checkout, and then caught up with us at the end of the route. Because from the south starting point of the route to the finish point, which would have been, I guess, due northwest, would have been 58 miles from end to end. So the fact that the route was so dense lent itself to being able to have kind of one central overnight point for them, and they just handed off Sherpa duties midway. And my brother had made a good point, you know, that it's an endurance test for the rider, but it shouldn't, you know, people should know what they're signing up for. It shouldn't have to be an endurance test for the support folks. And he reported that this was a lot better from his standpoint than the 19 or 20 hours he spent with me out on the mountain for my regular 8848, which he had Sherpa'd. So I take his input as better gospel than mine, since I wasn't the support for either one on that count. So it definitely helped to have two people do that.
All right, cool.
But that meant that I only ever carried one water bottle, and I only ever carried, and I didn't have to carry a lot of fuel. Like early on, it was just, you know, like, just find me once an hour and give me a new bottle and a new Pop-Tart, and you know, we'll keep it moving like that. And then I had a very low tech. I'd done little maps on that were blow ups on PowerPoint slides, and printed them out, and then highlighted, these are the overnight descents. Like, I want a vehicle behind me with the headlights on for those descents. Like, if you follow me or don't follow me for the rest of the time, but at these highlighted portions, like, be there, because I can, otherwise I will lose average speed by nursing my brakes all the way down. So
definitely,
you know, the descents overnight, you know, that was highlighted on the map to make sure that that I had a set of headlights, as well as vehicle headlights, as well as my bike headlight.
For sure. I'm assuming there's a lot of deer probably in the area. Like, those are the concerns, right?
There are. I mean, just vehicles and my own visibility as well. But mm-hmm. Yeah, they're animals is to account for as well.
Yeah, for sure. And in the night is when you won't see one. You're fatigued. One jumps out in the road. You might not hit it, but you might hit the deck by trying to avoid something like that, right? So headlights kind of disperse some of the concerns there. Okay, so you thought about basically everything from support standpoint, everything.
Yeah.
Pretty experienced endurance rider, so you had your nutrition pretty dialed. Did you change anything from shorter, from longer time attempts to this one? Were you trying to pack in more sugar in a shorter amount of time, or did you just stick to what you'd always done, tried and true?
I tried to eat a lot more carbs in the first 5 hours because I had done a recon ride of the first 100 kilometers, you know, 3,000 meters in April. And I'm not much of a cramper, but I cramped right around 100 kilometers, 3,000 meters. And when I looked and thought about it, like a lot of, you know, on a weekend ride, it's not a, you know, if I do a longer ride on a weekend, something around 4 hours, 4 hours, 20 minutes, 100 kilometers, 2,000 meters is kind of a usual, but that's like 18, 19 meters per kilometer. And doing 30 meters per kilometer, those first, that first 100 kilometers, my diagnosis of that situation was I should at least try to eat more carbs. I'm not sure if that is what caused that. You know, cramping is seems to be more of a black box now than, you know, we previously thought when it was just sort of an electrolyte sodium presumption that that was the issue. So I tried to really eat a lot more early in this ride and also kind of give myself permission to do the first 100 kilometers a little slower than I had during the recon ride, because I was trying to hit an average speed of at least 20 kilometers an hour in the recon ride when I had cramped up. And I was like, look, if I want to ride at the end with anything, I mean, it's already going to be slow, but if I want to hold on at the end, I probably need to also be a little restrained at the beginning to make sure that I don't put too much workload in that early portion. So that was one of the things for diet. I used like a high carb drink mix that doesn't have any electrolytes. So I would put a little bit of scratch in the bottle with the beta fuel to get a little electrolyte there. I'd eat a Pop-Tart. I used the SIS gels that have electrolytes, so I would get the electrolytes there. But it was in a couple of those gels were the caffeine ones, but you know, maybe four over the course of the whole ride. And then I can't eat them at night because I can't see to open them up, and they don't hold together as well. But I also made up a bunch of the Alan Lim rice cakes, you know, with the chicken apple sausage and scrambled eggs and things like that. And so during daylight, I could eat those, but I found at night I couldn't see what I was trying to open, and I just dropped stuff on the roadway.
Right. So some real food though, which is nice if you can do it right. So
the savory makes a big difference. I throw a lot of soy sauce in that and try to make sure that it is a strong contrast to the sweetness.
Yeah. So that you can continue to stomach the foods too. So anecdotally, what was easier, this one or the one that took nearly 36 hours or the first, you call it failed attempt, but you know, you rode 38 hours, you did a Rome, you did it. So is it easier to do it shorter, or was it harder because you're packing in more elevation into a shorter period of time and mileage? Or are they all equally awful?
I mean, they were all hard. It's a little bit difficult for me to give you a prescriptive answer to that, because I think that part of the evolution is also my comfort with doing these kind of efforts. So I don't think I've been exactly the same rider doing each of them. I don't think that there's a dramatic difference, but I think even just experientially, what you're prepared for. They're all hard. Anybody who does these is up for for some kind of badge for tolerating suffering. But this one, I kind of appreciated not having to work through getting stiff and overnight with a stop and having to limber up again. I appreciated that, as opposed to kind of taking the break, getting the shower, getting a little sleep, getting a little rest. And then, you know, that first 30 minutes of respinning, you know, to get started again, I didn't miss that at all.
That's a hard 30 minutes.
Yeah.
To get rolling again. Yeah.
So they're all tricky. I think there are some things you, when you're doing for a short time, you almost have to make improvements in that. On the first one I did, I just never thought about them. Like the buddy that was helping me, when he would drive the vehicle, we were in a national park. And so he would maybe go to like a rest stop, you know, like a place that had a parking lot and a bathroom, you know, and he might stop there and wait for me to catch up to him. But he's a gregarious guy. He parks somewhere so he can talk to people. He parks somewhere for his line of sight, far away from the restroom, you know, pops the back, sets everything out. You pull up and you're like, I didn't realize it at the time, but like, so you go to where he is, you set your bike down, then you clip-clop all across the parking lot to the restroom maybe, because you can't just, right, you know, whiz in the bush, you know. Then you clip-clop all the way back. Maybe you forgot the chamois cream, but you really need to reapply, clip-clop. I mean, like, there's so much wasted spatial movement, yeah, in some situations that when you're doing, hey, this is 24 hours, just like stop on the roadside. Like, I want the bottle, I'm going to unclip, I'll put a foot down. You know, we're not handing bottles out the window, but we're going to keep it moving. And I think that in some ways makes it a very lean project. Whereas, you know, the first time we weren't even thinking about, you know, hey, where you go, park right by the restrooms as close as you can, so the rider doesn't have to, you know, spend a lot of time and distance walking back and forth. You know, don't, there were things like that that just, they sort of solve themselves when you know you're trying to follow a time really sharply.
Definitely. So that leads perfectly into my next question. So you stopped the clock at just over 23 hours, but what was your moving time?
20 hours, 26, 54. So 20 hours, 27 minutes.
So you only had, less than 2.5 hours of stop time.
2 hours, 36 or 37 minutes of stop time. Now I planned to try to get under 2 hours. So I, when I realized that my average speed was holding up, I tried to be really conservative when I estimated that. And so when I realized my average speed was doing better than the estimates I'd used to plan, I did relax the stoppage time over the last third of the effort. And I had one problem that was just a stupid mistake that anyone doing this should avoid. And that was, I let my Wahoo battery die by not paying enough attention to it. I had, you know, 180 gram power bank, you know, ready and waiting. I had the one new piece of equipment I had on was a different cycling computer mount because I wanted to run a headlight directly underneath the, I just had the regular standard Wahoo, you know, mount that comes with it. But I wanted to run the headlight directly under the bike computer so that I could take the headlights off of the handlebars and not have that drag. Just put it in front of the head tube.
Right.
And I needed a mount that was big enough to accommodate a Wahoo Roam so that my bolt would sit far enough forward that I could put a charging cable in the back. Because,
okay,
you know, the standard mount that comes with the bolt has it too close to the stem and handlebar to stick a USB-C cable in the back of it.
You don't have room for the wire in the port, right?
Right. So, okay, you know, I found some, you know, $40 mount online that did both of those things and was quick on and off for the GoPro mount for the headlights. So it was perfect solution. So I had planned to, and I found a, you know, 3 or 4 foot charging cable to run from the power bank in my jersey pocket to the back of the bike computer. And I checked it at like 40% and then forgot about checking it again. Meanwhile, it's dark and you're bored. And, you know, like during daylight hours, I don't have any backlighting on the head unit. But overnight, it was on for sort of 4 seconds. And I was, of course, I kept pressing the button to be like, making sure it, you know, how's my vertical now? Is it still counting vertical? Like, how am I doing? And I guess I wore the thing down by keeping to hit, you know, to visualize the information on it and that backlighting. And so I had a spot in mind where I planned to put the power bank in my pocket and ride for 40 kilometers with it in, and it died short of there. And so we had to throw it on a power bank from the vehicle that was much more powerful, because it has to get up to at least 5% before it can turn on and begin to recover the ride. So I lost about 20 minutes and a little bit of kilometers and a little bit of vertical meters because I didn't realize it had turned off.
Right.
Until like a kilometer or two later, when I hit the button to see like, oh, what am I at now? And it didn't respond. And it was,
Thank God, you caught it when you did, though.
That was crisis. But yeah, you know, we got it on the power bank that was strong enough to give it a good boost. It recovered the ride. You know, I lost a little bit of what was measured. And if you look at the Strava file, it's the place where there's an abnormally straight line about 230 kilometers in. And then once it was up and going, then I could transition it to the power bank and continue riding. But there was about 20 minutes roadside where we were all kind of like, did we just screw this whole thing up 230 kilometers in by
and is it going to reload
by me? No,
like, is it right? Is it going to start where I left off? Oh yeah. Oh,
well, I'm glad that I didn't have to send you a sheepish email to be like, hey Pete, you know that attempt? It was going well, but then I, you know, jacked it all up by ignoring my Wahoo battery. So. If anyone's doing this, just keep checking it. And especially if you're like fiddling around with the backlit display just to relieve the boredom. Like I nearly torpedoed the whole thing with that silliness.
Yeah, I'm like having a physical stress reaction just thinking about that in the dark, that panicky moment. Well, Phil, thanks for joining me again and breaking this down. That, and congratulations! Like, what an incredible effort and an incredible ride! And you're inspiring a bunch of people. You deserve all of the kudos and shoutouts that you've got. One last question, though: you have to explain your Strava name to me because it's pretty awesome.
I mean, it just comes from George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars, you know, the 70s band, and. When I was a kid, I occasionally fooled around trying to figure out what I would tag things with. I wasn't much of I had no spray paint skills, but I would fool around with a marker. And because my name starts with a PH, I'd fooled around with P-Funk as a kind of a marker tag on notebooks and things like that. And so when I first signed up for Strava, it was something that, you know, I just wanted a nom de guerre for putting it on there.
Not your name. That's awesome. Well, everybody should give you a follow if they want to see some pretty epic efforts. What's next?
I scared my brother this morning. We were chatting and he's been a huge help on all of this, but I said, you know what? I don't think Andy has a double Rome badge out there on the site. he told me that this was probably a sign that I needed some kind of help. So I don't know if that will be it. I'd prefer to just do one with him. That would be fun. The thought did cross my mind. So I must be recovering enough that I'm willing to think about what the next challenge might be.
That is awesome. Well, the cool thing about the Rome is that even without changing the mileage or the elevation, or doubling it, you could just do it somewhere else, right? And it's a whole different puzzle. Or you could say, what if I did it in 500K, or could I do it in 600K in 36 hours? Like, you can really, it's pretty elastic, which is really, really cool and challenging. So I can tell you're not done. So I hope that we can connect again and keep inspiring people. And just again, congratulations. It's an incredible effort.
Thanks a lot. And thanks for everybody that's been on the podcast to check on this topic specifically, but all of them. I love to see the routes when people post them in the Strava group on for Hell's 500 and things like that. And the pod's a great way to feature it. And I'm still such waiting for Ronan to show us how to really do it.
I know every time I see that Ronan's posted a ride, I'm like, is this the one? Yes, he's coming. I know he's gonna hear this and reach out. So thanks, Phil. Appreciate it. It's good to catch up.
Thank you, Pete. All right, take care.
Another big thank you to Phil and a congratulations on that incredible ride. I'm going to look at that fondly in the Hall of Fame. Thank you everybody for tuning in. If you're able to give us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show, that goes a long way to help us find new audience members. So we do appreciate you doing so, or just take a moment to write a quick review on whatever podcast platform you're using. And thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back as soon as we can with another guest episode.